Praise the Lord, Sante. The end of this retreat. Later on. But we always see it as a good retreat. So there should be see some happiness and some joy and some peace in the people who have been on this retreat. It's as if that through the practice of meditation, through some of the teachings, that we can let go of some of those burdens which we keep carrying around with us. And that we lessen all the things we worry about, complain about, and the mind becomes more peaceful. And the whole point of the meditation is to take you on that path to peace, stillness, happiness, kindness, and also insight. It is true that without insight, without understanding, there can't be that much progress. But in all those years which I've been as a monk, everybody claims to have insight, which is why they argue with one another. And you wonder who's right and who's wrong. And so often, you can measure one's insight not by how powerfully one can argue with another person and win in debates, but you usually find out that the sign of insight is how calm and peaceful you are, how happy you are. In other words, it's insight which allows you to let go of burdens. You don't carry things around. Whatever happens to you in your life, you're able to just let it be and let it go. If there's something you can do, you do it. If there's nothing you can do, you do nothing and sit down and have a cup of tea. As in that story of that British soldier. Please excuse me, at the end of a Dhamma talk, I'm not quite sure which talk I gave or the last talk somewhere else, or which talk I gave here, and which story. The British soldier one, I think I did have given here already.
No.
Really, that's before?
Gaia.
I was in Gaia, okay. This is how we can make use of our meditation practice in very difficult situations in our daily life. Of course, this was a story told to me when I was a school teacher over in Devon by an elderly English teacher who was about to retire. And he told me that when he was in Burma during the Second World War, he was fighting the enemy at that time, which was Japanese soldiers, but he wasn't a military man. He just had to join up as every other young man of that age had to enlist. There's not much choice in the matter. It was either that or sometimes go to jail as a conscientious objector. But anyway, he soon found himself in Burma fighting a war for real with real bullets in a very dangerous situation. And one day that he was out with a group of other troops, about six or seven of them in all, just doing a little patrol in the jungle. And unfortunately, the scout, who was part of that group of soldiers, came back and told them the bad news, that unexpectedly, they had stumbled into a huge number of Japanese troops. They were vastly outnumbered, completely surrounded, with no way out. He thought this would be his end, that this would be the time he would die, because this was war. But, as often is the case, I've been told by psychologists, in difficult situations like that, no one knows who will be the hero and who would actually crumble in fear. And even though he was not really a professional soldier, he had this surge of heroism. He volunteered, let's try and fight our way out. Even though the chances of anyone getting out is very, very small. Nevertheless, we'll die like patriots. And maybe we can take a few of the enemy with us. Let's fight our way out. In these times, he would be like Bruce Willis. And I think it's Die Hard. Is that correct? Fighting impossible odds, but always, somehow, managing to survive. So anyway, the captain said, no, we will not fight our way out. Instead, I order all of you to sit down and have a cup of tea. It was the British Army, after all. And, especially at war, orders had to be obeyed. And he thought this was the most stupid, craziest thing he'd ever done in his life. Imagine, you're about to die, surrounded by enemy soldiers, and battle-hardened, and vastly outnumbered. Who can think of a cup of tea at that time? But he had to. And in the time it took them to make a cup of tea and start drinking it, the scout came back and said, put everything away quickly. The enemy has moved. There's a way out. And of course, he escaped and everyone else escaped, which was why he could tell me the story many years later. And it meant that a very wonderful example. He credits the wisdom of that captain for saving his life. He said not just once, but many times. Later on in his life, he had terminal cancer. Nothing could do. All treatments, didn't know anything could help him. It was like, again, being in the jungle, surrounded by the enemy, no way out. So instead of just worrying about the situation, what did he do? Sit down, had a cup of tea. In other words, he relaxed. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. So simple wisdom. And of course, you know, things happen, somebody found some treatment, wherever the tumor started to lessen or something, he managed to survive his cancer. So there's a very important teaching there. When there is nothing to do, learn how to relax. Even though it might be your last moments, you're dying. Or something even worse. If we struggle, then we find that we just make things worse. And it also means that when an opportunity does present itself, we're too tired and too stressed to take advantage of it. And I remember that story very often in monastic life. So often in life, sometimes you're in difficult situations, things don't turn out as you want to. There's nothing you can do, so do nothing. Very often, especially in my teaching career, that, you know, you have many invitations to come here and to go there, and many people are waiting for you to listen to and some talks. And on this one occasion that I was turned up in Perth Airport, I was going to give a series of talks over in Indonesia. And many people, the people in the venue had hired big halls, many posters, lots of people were turning up for the talk. And as soon as I got to the airport, the flight was cancelled. The Garuda flight. And I saw people banging on the desks. You can't do this to us. We booked a ticket. You've got to find the flight. You felt very sorry for the poor people manning the desks. It wasn't their fault that the flight was cancelled. And it doesn't matter how hard they banged the desk, the aircraft would not magically appear. All that would happen is the fist would get more and more sore. And anyway, we did find out it was not the aircraft company's fault. It was the fact that this was the time when there was a really big cases of bird flu in Indonesia. And Garuda is a bird. So I managed to borrow a phone and phone my host and said, please apologize to everybody and please tell them the reason for the delay is because the Garuda aircraft has got bird flu. And apparently, he gave the talk that evening, my host, and as soon as he told that joke, he said, it was like Ajahn Brahm was actually here. Not in anybody, but his joke managed to arrive. So, all of these times, there's nothing you can do. Please, relax, because life is out of control. That's some of the wisdom which we get. It doesn't go according to our schedule. Please don't worry, I'll try and keep the schedule today. That's out of compassion. But it is a sign of wisdom that you can learn to adapt to things. Too often, people try to keep the schedules and try to do the right thing because they're always afraid of what other people think of them. They don't want to let other people down, even though it's not their fault. But I heard this wisdom such a long time ago, and I always keep it with me, that it's this question of why are you so worried what other people think of you? Because I do recall, you know, when I was a young man, you know, chasing girls, trying to impress people, I was really concerned what other people thought of me. I had to have fashionable hairstyles, fashionable clothes, fashionable speech. And after a while, I became a monk before I really saw into all this trying to impress others, people's business. But then usually people, once they get past those early years and they get to their early middle age, people tend to just dress comfortably. Because you don't really care what other people think of you. You're going to do what you want to do. Have that independence. Not try to fit some stereotypes of fashion or speech. You are you. So in the middle age, you tend not to worry what other people think of you. And then you finally get to your senior year years. We get to this very quickly as monks and nuns, because of our teachings. So in those years, early years, you're worried what other people think of you. Middle years, you don't care what other people think of you. And when you become wise, you find that people weren't thinking about you anyway. They're thinking about themselves. So after a while, you don't go what other people think of you. You're trying your very best. And sometimes people can misunderstand, they can take it wrong, it's just the two fabrics in the wall. You suddenly get wise and you get relaxed in your interpersonal relationships. When I started teaching, I just wondered, is teaching the right thing for me? What happens if I give a talk and I offend people? What happens if I give a talk and everybody walks out and leaves? What happens if it just does not work? And I thought to myself, yeah, that'd be wonderful. Because then I can become a nice hermit monk, staying in my cave, not bothered by anyone, blissing out in the jhanas, not having to worry about travelling all over the place and giving talks. So hey, that'd be good. But then I thought, if I can teach and it really reaches people and they get wisdom out of that, that's wonderful, that's great. In other words, I can serve and help people. So either way, I win. Either way, I'm happy. No matter what happens. Then you find that when you don't have to impress, when you don't have to succeed, when it's okay to fail, you relax, you're at peace, and you usually always successful. People who try too hard are the ones who fail. Try too hard in relationships, try too hard in life, try too hard in meditation. You just get tense, and you just get headaches, pain, and you don't want to come to a meditation retreat ever again. You think, I can't meditate. Which is totally wrong. Everyone can meditate. But if you put the expectations that I have to achieve this, achieve that, then of course you will always fail. In monastery, we do a lot of outreach, and a lot of times, not because we plan, but just we get requests. And this request was to go and teach in a prison. I taught in many prisons over the years, and in this particular story, I've been teaching for a while and had many other duties to do, so I let some other monks take on that role of prison teaching. And so, I always told them that when you do volunteer in prisons, you must always keep a record of how many hours you spend inside volunteering, to be used as credit, in case someday you get sentenced for something. But on this occasion, somebody else was in the prison, and the prisoners who had seen this monk quite maybe five or six times, invited him, can you please stay an extra half an hour or an hour? Because now we want to talk to you, not just about meditation, we want to sort of, you know, relate to you. Now as a monk, we've got so many questions we'd like to ask. And so he stayed a little extra time and started asking, what's life like as a monk in an Australian monastery? Let's be honest about it. You know, we're not going to publish this in a book. We're not going to embarrass you. But little things, like what time do you get up in the morning? And he told them that in Buddhist monastery, where I'm supposed to be the boss, obviously you noticed I said supposed to be. Everyone is their own boss. Everyone has to look after themselves. I don't have CCTV cameras in the monks' rooms. So they're supposed to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And just at that statement, the prisoners were shocked. 4 o'clock in the morning! Even serial killers don't need to get up until 6 o'clock. What bad karma did you monks have to do to get up so early? But then he did qualify his statement. He said, it is optional, 4 o'clock in the morning. You can always get up earlier. So, then what do you do after 4 o'clock? You know, after going to the toilet and washing your face or whatever. He said, we meditate. What, you know, you haven't got like a TV, you can watch the late night movie. No, we don't have TVs in monastery. We just meditate. Okay then, well, what time does meditation finish? What time is your breakfast? Usually in Bodhinyana Monastery at 6:30. And what do you have for breakfast? You usually have like a mug. I usually have a mug with 3 Weetabix in it, some milk, bananas for this one, and a cup of tea. That's it. Is that all? They said. Because in prison, you can get anything. You can get noodles. You can get Asian porridge, Western porridge, you can get waffles, you can get pancakes, you can get bacon and eggs, you can get toast, you can get, what else do we start for breakfast? Sorry?
Bacon sausages?
Bacon sausages, eggs, anything. They want to sort of make sure all the prisoners are happy, then they don't cause trouble. Some of those prisoners are big guys. So, anything you want to have for breakfast. So, what do you do after breakfast? And I ask you to work. You know, even I'd love to try and do some physical work whenever they'd let me. The last time I was, because I built a lot of that monastery, and I had to lay bricks and do plumbing and put on the roof and everything. The last time I was fixing up the roof, I was on top of the roof, and the caretaker took a photograph of me. And they said, Ajahn Pal, you must not go up on top of roofs anymore. Because if you fall off, we haven't got a teacher anymore. And number two, you have to check whether the rafters of that roof can support. But it's a lot of work, especially on the ground. Sometimes I can do some concrete work. I love concrete. I don't know why, but just anyway, the last job, pushing wheelbarrows and concrete. So on this occasion, we're building something, so all the monks get in there and just mix up the concrete and splash it around and just get cement dust all over you. It's really good fun. It's also important, doesn't matter how senior you are, that you help with everybody else. It's like a communal effort. Just because, you know, I'm old and been a monk for many years doesn't mean you can't be part of the gang, as it were, part of the Sangha. So we all try and work together whenever we can. So, after finishing off this concrete work, I was going back to my hut to have a shower, change my robes, and then get ready for lunch. But on the way from the work site to my hut, I was going to pass a Sri Lankan, she was a Sri Lankan woman. Must have been very high class because she had a very expensive sari on. And also, she had so many bangles on her wrists that from a distance, I thought it was the ice cream truck. So, she came up to me and asked me, she said, so this is my first time in this monastery. Can you please tell me where I can find Ajahn Brahm? And I thought very quickly, and I said, well, if you go down to the dining room there, he'll probably be there in about 10 or 15 minutes. And off she went. And this is a true story. Sometimes you cannot invent stories which are better than the truth. The truth is funny enough. So I had a shower, changed to some cream robes, went into the hall, and there was this lady waiting for me. And I gave her a little talk, answered some of her questions. At the end of the week, she said, this is wonderful to see sort of a real monk in a wonderful monastery, practicing meditation, keeping your precepts. Oh, thank you so much, it's so inspiring. But, she said, on the way here, I met one of your monks, and he was very untidily dressed, with lots of dirt all over him. That's not appropriate to have such monks in your monastery. And I said, oh, really, man? Okay, I will talk to him later. And all the while, she never figured out it was me who was that dirty monk. That's interesting about one's perception, what one expects from a monk or a nun, when one actually sees. So if what you see is not what you expect, then deny it, can't be that person. Later on, when you clean up and you give Dhamma talks, you know, that must be him. Really crazy, our perception. But anyway, we do work hard. And when I told the prisoners in Australia how hard we worked, honestly, they were just stunned. They would never make us work that hard in prison. We would refuse. So what about lunch? And again, over here, you know, the Venerable Chandra spoils me. And we eat on a table with plates, but, you know, in the monastery we eat up with bowls. And in those bowls, what is in your one bowl? And sometimes, at the bottom, I just, one of the Anagarika's trainees, it's their job to take my bowl and bring it upstairs. But sometimes you put everything in the bowl. It's usually nicely apportioned before he brings it up the top there. But shaking it about, not being careful, by the time it gets on the top, everything's all mixed up. So quite often, what was one of the last things I had, was strawberry ice cream on curry. Why did you start to grimace? Have you ever had strawberry ice cream on curry? How do you know? It's disgusting. You've never tried it. You can see this is an important insight. Even things we don't know, we never experience, oh, I can't do that, no, that's terrible. Actually, you were right. It wasn't. And those prisoners say, wow, even in solitary confinement, they give you a tray with different compartments on it. That's disgusting. I say, well, it all gets mixed up in your tummy anyway. We just mix it up beforehand. Efficiency. So what do you do after lunch? Well, after lunch, some monks have a rest, or they can meditate. That all, just meditate again. Can't you play sport? Get fit. And sometimes, when I first went to Perth, I thought it would be a good idea to sort of, you know, maybe start a monastery football team. So that we could play the Catholics or the Anglicans. But just actually to get some interfaith connection. Because I don't know if any of you have been on interfaith committees, but you talk to a person over a table. That's not really the same, that's not real life. You don't just talk to people. Actually do things together. So that may be able to get some better sort of harmony and understanding together. But then I thought about it more deeply. And if you have a Buddhist soccer team, how would it work? So I tell the story earlier about soccer teams. Okay. A Buddhist soccer team. Number one, it'd have to be playing by Buddhist principles. If the other team wanted the ball, you give it to them. Let go. Non-attachment. If you're the goalkeeper and the ball came into the area and you leapt up to catch it, no grasping. Let it go. And you wouldn't want to score a goal and upset your opposition. So if I was the striker for the Buddhist team and had an open goal, I would always kick it just over the bar or to outside of the goalpost. Because the last thing you want to do is upset the other people by scoring. However, if it's in your area, score own goals. Does that make people happy? So obviously a Buddhist sports team would not work. So we don't play sport in the afternoon. We meditate. Oh, okay, so what time do you have dinner? Dinner, the monk said. We don't have dinners in Buddhist monasteries. We just have those, you know, eating in the morning time, nothing afternoon. Wow, they said. Nothing at all, yeah. Isn't it amazing, even though you only eat in the morning? You still put on weight. If I ate three meals a day, I don't know what size it would be. Okay. So what do you do in the evening? Can you play cards? Gamble poker or whatever? I said, no. We go back to our rooms and we meditate. And I think that one of the prisoners said, don't you get tired of meditating? And the monk said, yeah. Stop. Well, it's not going well. There are this. So well, what time do you go to bed? Bed, he said. We don't have beds in monastery. We sleep on the floor. Those of you who've been in my cave, do I have a bed in there? To the mattress. Sleep on the floor. So it's much
better sleeping on the floor. Because I think actually the other day in the other place we stayed, that they had a very small single bed, quite high. I was really afraid of falling off. This is actually in Australia. Many people get killed by sharks. And so many tourists don't want to go there and swim in the ocean. Until somebody actually pointed out the statistics. More people in Australia die falling out of bed than they do being eaten by sharks. Statistics prove that. So it's not when you're on the floor, it's great. You can just roll whichever way you want. You never fall off. So anyway, the prisoners were actually quite shocked. Compared to a prison, how austere is the Buddhist monastery? And the next thing one of the prisoners said, they were just focusing on the austerity of a Buddhist monastery. And they had kindness towards this monk. And so they blurted out the unforgettable words, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" You've got an invitation to stay in prison. You know, with compassion. Because it was much more comfortable in there. So, he told me that story, we all laughed. But then, you get the insight. Why, if a prison is more comfortable than a monastery, why isn't there a waiting list of people trying to get into prison? If monastery is more austere, why is there a waiting list of people trying to get into monastery? What's the difference? And then you soon get to the conclusion. What is a prison? A prison is any place or situation you don't want to be. You want to get out. That's called prison. It does not matter how comfortable, how much food, how comfortable it is inside. If you don't want to be there, it is a prison. And if you are in a place which is austere, but you want to be there, you're happy to be there, like in a monastery, it's not a prison anymore. It's freedom. You want to be here. No desires to get out. So that opens up a lot of insight, not just into meditation, but into life. The next time you're meditating here, ask yourself, do you want to be here? Or would you rather be somewhere else? If you want to be somewhere else, you just made a prison for yourself. Doesn't matter if you're aching, tired, if you want to be here, you're free. You feel that freedom. Happy to be here. If you're in a job you hate, when you go to the job tomorrow, it's like going back to prison again. This has just been a temporary release while you come to this retreat. If you're in a relationship which is causing a lot of stress and difficulty, your relationship is a prison. If you're in a body which is sick and tired, your body is in the prison because you don't want to be there. How do you escape from the prisons of life? You don't have to change your husband or wife. You don't have to change your job. You don't have to heal all those sicknesses in the body. You don't have to get into jhana to feel free. If you're happy to be here, changing your attitude, changing what's the way you look at life, then you find you're free. Happy to be here. I catch myself sometimes when I'm meditating. Am I happy to be here? Or am I tired? I don't want to go to my room. Fed up with teaching you guys and girls and stuff. Oh, what a waste of time. I don't get anything out of this. except happiness. So, when I'm happy to do this, I feel free, relaxed. One of the jobs which I do, which is absolutely crazy, is to sign books and have my photograph taken. And I can't. What do you want to have a photograph of me for? I'm not hot. I'm fat and old. I still have a story for that. This is wisdom which is way beyond me. But in some places, and Singapore, most of Singapore, Indonesia is the chief of those countries who want to take photographs of me. There's ones that are just only transiting in the airport in Singapore. This group of Indonesians, they spotted me, can we have a photograph? Okay, group photograph, but then group photograph, and then just one with their friends, and then individually. Wow. Then I've got a plane to catch. Oh, just one more. And they were calling my name out when I got to the departure gate. So I felt really stuck, almost missed the plane. But in Indonesia, after the talks, a whole line of people to sign books, have photographs taken. It took 2 hours for all the people to go past. I don't know how many books I signed. And halfway in between, no, maybe after an hour, really wanted to go to the toilet. They couldn't let me go to the toilet. There's too many people in the line. And anyway, even if I did go to the toilet, the males bring their books into the toilet. And go, well, honestly, that's what they do. So then I caught myself. What am I doing this for? This is not in the contract of being a monk when I signed up. But then I caught myself and said, stop, you're suffering. Why am I suffering? Because I didn't want to be there, I want to be someone else. As soon as I caught myself, right, okay, I want to be here. And so I tried to smile as much as I possibly could. Sign the books as carefully for each one, because I wanted to be there. And I don't mind, I don't know why they want to do this. But I'll get some really good responses there, because I was happy to be there to people. Some people were waiting an hour in line, and I signed their book, they felt very happy. But I must admit, the one which I would always remember was this maybe 19, 20-year-old Muslim young lady in a hijab. She was a practicing Muslim, but in Indonesia, they have a very, very good attitude. You can go to each other's religions, and many of them come to my talks. She came in a hijab with one of my books to sign. And when she, it was her turn, she came on the stage next to the table and I signed her book. Actually, before she handed over her book to be signed, she put her hand over her mouth. Oh shit, he's signing my book. Oh shit. That's in a Muslim country. That's just so cute. And she was excited and she lost it. I mean, I don't care if you're Muslim or a Christian or whatever. Sometimes people get excited and, oh, he's signing my book. That's so sweet. Anyhow, when you're happy to be here, then of course you don't get so exhausted or fighting where you are. So this is all the wisdom you have, which works in meditation, which works in life, which works when you get home. You're waiting for the bus. Where's that bus coming? Do you want to be somewhere else? Or are you happy to be here? When you're happy to be here, you're free. So this gives some wonderful insights into not just meditating, how meditation works, but how life works. There will come a time when you get really sick, you're in your deathbed, and are you happy to be there? To be dying? Or do you want to go somewhere else? Do you want to be alive? If you're happy to be here, you'll feel so free. You're going to die anyway. Any pain won't last that long. Zajan Chah said, you'll either get better or you'll die. So you don't have to endure that long. So I'm free, so happy to be here. So this gives me the opportunity to go to for some very deep wisdom on enlightenment itself. When I was even at school, now I went to the good school up in Hammersmith, the Latimer upper school. These days have all film stars go there. Hugh Grant goes there, and who else goes there? Oh, there's a fellow who was one of the lead actors in the Harry Potter series, Professor Snape, whatever his name is. Anyway, he was a very famous actor, apparently. That's why I don't know his name. Because he's quite close to the BBC, our studio. So, and I went there, because it was, say, a direct grant school at that time, got a scholarship from my primary school. And so they had a chaplain, an Anglican chaplain. I remember his name, Reverend Evans, Rev Ev, we called him. And anyway, I was interested, I was open, I asked, went to make a little appointment with him, and asked him, well, you know, what is this God? I wasn't trying to put anybody down, I just wanted to know. I couldn't get my head around this idea of a God. And so, you know, I remember him telling me that God is like ineffable. You can't really describe it. It's the beginning and end of all things. The Alpha and Omega. And the ground of all being. Indescribable, beyond words. When he says things like that, to me, I understood that he didn't understand what he was talking about. It was gobbledygook. The Alpha and Omega, that means that God is the street directory, like the A to Z. You said, oh, you don't have A to Z street directories anymore, now we've got Google Maps, do you?
Yeah.
You do, still? Okay, anyway. Well, what much is it? He could never tell me, it's indescribable. And to me, if you can't describe it and put it into intelligible words, it doesn't exist. And so, that actually was confirmed later on in life in quantum physics when Werner Heisenberg, one of his wonderful quotes was, if you understand quantum physics, if you really understand it, this is supposedly one of the most complicated of ideas to get your head around, if you really understand it, you'll be able to explain it to the barmaid serving you a pint of beer in the pub, and she will understand what you're talking about. The measure of your understanding is your ability to explain it to others in simple language. There's a lot of truth to that. So anyway, I wasn't convinced by that, but then later I went to, I think it was the Sri Lankan temple, and asked the Venerable Hambro, the head monk there, now what is Nirvana? And he said, well, Nirvana is ineffable, indescribable, the ground of all being. You can't put it into words. As I've heard that somewhere before. And he wasn't really impressed. But then later on, you know, he started to hang around teachers like Ajahn Chah. And eventually you came across nice little teachings which made it easy to understand. So anyone can understand it. And the best simile which I have heard, developed, and even published was a simile of the five children playing wishing game. Simile. So if you want to understand what we're meditating for and how all this fits in to actually the teachings of a Buddha, the five children playing a wishing game. The rules of the wishing game are, you have a wish, whoever gets the best wish wins the wishing game. And the first child put their hand up and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a new Nintendo computer game. It's a long time since I developed the story. I have no idea about computer games. I don't know if Nintendo is the sort of game a young person would want to get, but you get the idea. A new computer game. Second kid, more time to think. Said, no, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a computer game shop. If I owned a store, then I could get many computer games. And I could upgrade them whenever a new one comes out. It's obviously a much better wish than the first kid. If ever you are in any sort of debate or contest like that, always be the first person to answer. It reminded me of that story of of these three religious leaders who, as I was saying earlier, instead of just talking about the differences or where their religions coincide, they wanted to actually to go a bit further, get those friendships, break down those barriers, have trust with one another. So they started having lunch together. And even just having lunch together was not really enough. So they decided to try and play some games together or something to be able to try and bond and understand one another. And eventually they started playing cards together. And then they decided to play, you know, seriously, poker for money. And in that place it was illegal. So somebody whistleblowed on them and the police arrested them all. There was a Jewish rabbi, the Christian priest, and a Buddhist monk in court for gambling. And again, that would be the first one to go up there. So the first one happened to be the Christian priest, and the magistrate looked at him in the eye and said, "Were you gambling?" And faster than most people can notice, he looked up in the sky and said, "Jesus, forgive me." "No." And then the next guy was the rabbi. "Rabbi, were you gambling?" And I don't know if this is still current in England, but I remember doing this when I was a kid at school. You put your hand behind your back and cross your fingers. "No," he said. "Do you still do that in England? Cross your fingers behind your back?" I don't know where that came from. Anyway, that's what he did. "No, okay, you can go." Now came the Buddhist monk. "Venerable sir, were you gambling?" And the Buddhist monk, he can't look up the sky and says, "Please, Jesus, forgive me." His hands were in front, couldn't cross them and deny. Buddhist monks have to be always honest. What about important precepts? "Were you gambling?" And the Buddhist monk replied, "With whom, your honour?" "With whom?" So back to the kids playing. The second kid was all winning. The third kid, more time to think, especially if Ajahn Brahm tells a joke in between, more time to contemplate, how can I do a better wish than a computer game store? He was thinking, it doesn't matter if he has access to computer games. His biggest obstacle was his parents. His parents will keep telling him, "Stop spending time playing computer games. Do your homework. Get your grades increased. Otherwise, you're going to be stupid. Don't spend so much time playing computer games." So he thought, if I had, say a billion. Now let's make it 10 billion. 10 billion pounds. That's my wish. With 10 billion pounds, I could buy my own computer game shop and next, buy my own school. If I owned the school and employed the principal and all the teachers, they wouldn't dare give me bad grades. And then I can graduate from school. And when I've graduated from school, I can buy my own university, like Mr. Trump does. And then I can award myself big degrees. My parents will be happy and I can spend all my time playing computer games. With 10 billion, I can, whenever I think I need something else, I'll be able to have enough money to buy it. With 10 billion pounds, I won't need anything anymore. I can get whatever I want. It's a pretty good wish. So the fourth person was much smarter. She said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish about the computer game store, the second wish, $10 billion, £10 billion. For my third wish, I'd have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. So the fourth child had the infinity of wishes. That's a hard one to beat. Until the fifth child came along and said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any wishes ever again. That's an enlightened one. So content, you don't need any wishes. The end of desire. Happy at last. The fourth child, infinity of wishes, that is the people who go into politics to become powerful. It answered a question I had a long time ago. Why is it that very wealthy people can't just retire and enjoy their wealth? Why do they have to stand for being presidents, being prime ministers and stuff? They have the money, but they don't have the power to get their wishes fulfilled. That's why they get into positions like a Trump. Why on earth does anyone want to become a president of the United States? Power. Get your wishes fulfilled. So that's the fourth child. Infinity of wishes. Power. And the third child, just wealth. And the fifth child, contentment. Not needing any more wishes ever again. The end of greed, hatred, delusion. No more desire. Happy at last. Now you understand why we meditate that way. Sitting down, this is good enough. Happy to be here. Let go, relax. Being aware of what you're experiencing. Caring for it, embracing it. But not trying to change it. No more craving, no more wanting. Otherwise known as unconditional loving kindness. The door of my heart's open to this moment. And everything in it, unconditionally. Come in, I don't want you to change. You're good enough. Have you ever received unconditional love? One magical moment. I suppose maybe Ajahn Charles, my teacher, so maybe he could have given me unconditional love, but not as great as I received from this one monk who I went to see. A monk called Ajahn Tate in Thailand. Amazing monk. When I first ordained in Thailand, he was in the hospital with terminal cancer, having the best treatments available, sponsored by the King of Thailand at the time. And then when the prognosis was, there's nothing more we can do, you're going to die soon. His response was, well, if I am going to die, I'd rather die in my temple, in my monastery, which was on the Mekong River, outside of Nong Khai. I'd rather die there than in a hospital. So he got transported back to his monastery, where he lived happily for another 20, 25 years. It's sometimes weird with cancers. You know, sometimes it's not just your body, there's something much more going on. To the point, I think some of you might be, some of you might like this story, some might be a bit disturbed by it. There was Ted from Chancellor Street over in Lancashire. Close to the Pennines. And because he was that age, he was a smoker, and he gave it up, but by that time there was damage to the lungs and stuff. So eventually he was diagnosed terminal cancer, put in a hospice. The hospice was just like a waiting room before you went to the crematorium. In other words, there's only one way out, and that was usually in the box. So he went there to die. maybe a week, 2 weeks or something. So when he was there the first night, the nurse came up and said, "Ted, what would you like for dinner?" And Ted replied, "Well, I've got diabetes, so nothing sugary or sweet. I've got hardened arteries, so no salt, please. I've got really thickened arteries, so nothing which is oily, because I have cholesterol." And the nurse looked at him and said, "Ted, what on earth are you talking about? You're not going to die because of your diabetes or because of your cholesterol level or because of your hardened arteries. You're going to die of cancer. Ted, you can eat whatever you want." And Ted's eyes went as wide as a dinner plate. He was about to serve all the things which he was banned for him for years. Everything greasy, syrupy, salty, which he craved, but his wife would never give him. He ordered. He really enjoyed a gastronomic feast for the next 2 or 3 days. After which, he'd recovered so much that he walked out of the hospice and went home for another 6 months of life before the cancer returned and he came back to the hospice to die properly. I like that story because sometimes, as Shakespeare said, you don't live by bread alone. There's other things which keep you going. Your happiness and joy. So anyway, where do I get on to tell this muck? He was back in the monastery about 25 or 26 years. He was obviously a very wise, tame muck. He was one of those monks you'd put your hand up and say, "Yeah, he was perfectly like me." But this monk, he was so well known, I had to make an appointment to have an interview with him. And I waited until, it's going to be sometime in the morning, the monks told me. So I waited outside until it was my turn. And I had all these questions. I knew this was my only chance to ask questions of this monk. And all these deep questions to ask. And as soon as I went into the room in his presence, I saw this frail old monk sitting in a corner in this huge room which the king had built for him. Little old forest monk. And as soon as he turned around and saw me, every one of my questions just evaporated. No questions were there. And I felt just so accepted, unconditionally loved. I didn't need any questions because I did not need to improve. All my stupid defilements, all my stupid ideas, all my silly jokes, whatever, they were accepted. You did not need to get better or improve. The door of his heart was totally open. He could walk in and out on everyone. There's a sense of no more wanting to be better. No more noticing all my faults. No aversion. Total peace. It was just turning what I thought was enlightenment, what I thought was striving, what I thought was trying to achieve things, turning on his head. What do you want to achieve things for? There's no one there anyway to achieve stuff. Let go. Let this thing be. Spent all my life trying to improve. Get better grades at school, O levels, A levels, university degrees. To get on in life. He was teaching me, stop getting on in life. Just be. Stop. Pause. Let go. I didn't need to be anything better. What a wonderful teaching it was. Totally embrace where you were, who you were. Let go, relax. Hopefully that's something you got out of that guided meditation yesterday.
Imagine you're the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Nothing more to do. Free. Not trying to get anything more. Totally accepting where you are. Not striving. Peace at last. There's a lot of insight from those experiences. It's like lots of gold to be dug out. It's real gold, which gives you a really good idea why we have a world where we're never good enough. We always need to do more. We're never perfect enough. Never beautiful enough. Never wise enough. Never smart enough. Never learned enough. That really is called suffering. You want to be, that's actually described in Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Suffering is separation from where you want to be. How about wanting to be here? Not trying to get rid of things, but being with the things which you have. Peace at last. No desire. Not wanting anything in the whole world. Can you remember the most beautiful experiences you've ever had in life? Those times of utter contentment. I remember some of those, and it wasn't when I was rich or healthy. Sometimes just being with a good friend and realizing I don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world other than with the person sitting next to me. Totally at peace. Totally content. Not wanting anything. And those moments, sometimes it may be cold, maybe warm, maybe not the usual idea of perfection. But nevertheless, totally content, at peace, not wanting anything. The end of desire. That is called enlightenment. That's why you get tastes of that, hopefully, when you meditate. Sitting here, not trying to get jhanas, not trying to get nimittas, not trying to get healthy or wise. Just being at peace with this moment. Not trying to change anything at all. Peace at last. Then you know what happens. Stay like that for long enough and nimittas and jhanas, they come to you. That's the way it works. Just like, one more story. I'm going to say it anyway. There's that famous story, just to finish off this section. I told this to Gaia House, of the donkey and the carrot. Many of you know that one. I love that story. Yeah, that was one of my inventions, donkey and carrot. How can you teach people to let go? They said, let go and things all go wrong. For a while. But then they start to go on again. So the donkey and the carrot. Donkeys, that they are most stubborn people in the whole world. Much more stubborn than monks. So if you get a stick and try and beat the donkey to pull the cart, donkey won't move. So you don't use a stick to hit the donkey, you tie the stick to the back of the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. You tie a string to the to the end of the stick. On the end of the string you tie a carrot, and so the donkey sees a carrot. The donkey doesn't fear the stick, but the donkey loves the carrot. So the donkey moves towards the carrot. And as the donkey moves towards the carrot, the stick moves, the string moves, and the carrot moves. So the carrot is always a couple of feet in front of the donkey's head. And even the donkey runs as fast as it can. Still the carrot is 2 foot in front. No matter how hard that donkey strives, how much effort, how much force, how much commitment, still that carrot is 2 foot in front. It never catches a carrot. Before I go to the solution, does that really describe your life? Happiness, success, perfect relationship, financial security, good health. You can see it. You go towards it, it moves away.
go towards it, moves away. Boris Johnson and Brexit, you can see it. Moves towards it, goes away. Ah, that's typical of life. So poor old donkey never catches that carrot until the donkey becomes a Buddhist and learns meditation, learns wisdom. So what does the donkey do now? Now he's taken the three refuges. The donkey knows how to let go and stop. The donkey has been running after the carrot, so now the donkey stops. Stops running. It's still. Stops. Like everyone say, don't crave for things. Just stop. So what happens next? That carrot starts swinging away from the donkey. When you really put the cup down, it actually moves more at first when you put it down. But just be patient. When you let go of trying to control your breath, you go sleepy, you go restless. That's part of the course. Leave it alone. Because the carrot is further and further away. The carrot has never been more far before in your experience. It's 4 foot in front of you. But then, something strange happens. You're just sitting there in meditation, all these things start coming to you. The carrot's way over there, and now it starts swinging towards you. And soon, I know you've already run far ahead of where this carrot is in my story. But please let me indulge. The carrot is soon 2 foot in front of you. It's normal position. But never before has it become so fast towards you. Just like, you know, you let go, you know, the mind's been all over the place, but then it starts settling down by itself. And soon it's this normal place, you're watching the breath like you can normally do, but before with force, now with letting go. And the breath is becoming calm and calm and calm. It's just doing it by itself. You're just watching. So there's a carrot, normal place, but now coming towards you. Closer and closer and closer and closer crawls the donkey's mouth. And the last thing which the donkey has to remember, which some donkeys forget, you donkeys. Kindness, compassion, metta. I say the importance in all stages of meditation to have the act of kindness and loving kindness, metta, compassion. So at the very end, the carrot is so close to the donkey's mouth, the donkey remembers. Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. And that's how the donkeys catch carrots. Otherwise, I remember seeing donkeys, they've got this huge teeth in front. I always visualize, they don't have kindness in time, and the carrot bounces off the donkey's teeth. Maybe next time. So that's how donkeys catch carrots. That's how people become enlightened. That's even how they experience nimittas, in jhanas. You're racing after these things way too long. Stop. Let go. Stay still. Be content. And then these things come towards you. Thank you. So that's the talk for this morning. What do we do next? Nothing. That's my speciality. Okay. Because there are no questions, I don't want to do 5 minutes of questions.
5 minutes?
Well. Okay, quick one, yes?
You mentioned yesterday about the sutra, in the sutra teaching, you can allow positive thoughts or image or idea as an object of the mind to be mindful of.
Yeah.
What do you think is may lead to indulgence and also fantasy?
It can lead to indulgence and fantasy, then they're not positive things to watch. The sorts of positive things to watch are things like your kindness, your generosity, your goodness, your virtue, things which actually create a lesser sense of self when you start to disappear. Because giving, kindness, virtue is not about you. It's about others and sharing and caring. So this is actually where you don't get fantasies. You get peace instead. The idea is that you don't get more thoughts in the mind, but less. More peace. More serenity. When you're peaceful, then you can have wisdom. Next question? Wow! That was really quick. Okay, one, two, three.
When meditating and people are struggling with a racing mind or anxiety, heartbeat, whatever, and you say, give it kindness and compassion, is that not also a thinking process then that you develop? And is that not counterproductive? Or, you know, what does it mean, giving it kindness?
Giving it kindness. Is that a thinking process? Suppose that when you leave here, suppose you're going to the airport and you get a taxi. And you tell the taxi, well, I need to get to the airport and I need to go, don't go fast because I've just come out of a meditation retreat and I'm really so sensitive. And I'm also very compassionate, so please let other people come in front of me. Don't sort of, and please can you turn off your radios because I don't like to listen to music. And don't honk the horn. And out of kindness, if you see any cats or dogs across the road, please do not run them over. And just make sure that, you know, you drive with compassion, whatever you do. That taxi driver, he'll throw you out of the cab before you get to the top of the road. He'll say, madam, I know how to get to the airport. You just sit in the back and be quiet. All you need to do with the taxi driver is say, please get me to the airport. All you need to say to the mind is just be kind. And don't keep giving instructions to the mind. How the mind gets really fed up with you. Always telling me what to do. You give a bit of a nudge. Remember to be kind, mind. That's it. And leave it alone. I don't know your job in life, but because I'm a monk and I run monasteries, sometimes you have to give instructions to the monks. Can you please do this? I give them instructions and I let them carry out those instructions. I'm not behind them or over their shoulder telling them how to do it. I let them do it their way. And when I trust them, they never do it as good as if I'd done it myself. You know that one. But I let them do it and they learn it's good enough. But the most important thing is I just give them simple instructions. Not keep telling them what to do all the time. And that's with your mind. Whatever instruction you give it, just give it simple. And let the mind just do it. So, be kind, mind. Let it go. And then give your mind time to follow those instructions and make them work. If you keep interrupting, that's called thinking. Suggestions is something different. Okay, yeah, go on.
First of all, I want to thank you very much for these teachings, and especially this recollection of the Buddha meditation. It was very profound, and it really helped me. And I have more like suggestion than a question regarding your book you're writing, like teachings based on the suttas. Because when you, as you said yourself, that the carefulness in translation can be very like profound effects on the practice.
Indeed.
And when you were speaking about the four focuses of Satipatthana, the four focus Dhamma is like you translated as mind objects, and Ajahn Sujato actually translates this as principles. And I think it is very useful for consideration, because I believe that exactly this wisdom of this recollection of the Buddha is the principle of the mind, that when we see this principle, that when we want things, it's stuck, it goes to dukkha, and when we stop, it goes to wisdom. So yeah. I think personally that this word principle can be very useful. And but I'm not specialist, so I just want
to. Yes, no, you've got a point there. I acknowledge that. But mind objects, it's not really, it doesn't say anything, basically. Why those mind objects? Why not other mind objects? So you have a point there. Oh, you're right in the middle. Okay, yeah. Middle way is always more important. Yes.
You mentioned that in meditation, the light, the limiters are objects of the mind. Is it possible for the mind to lose all its objects? And when that happens, what happens to the mind?
Okay. It's the mind consciousness cannot exist without an object on which to rest. It's similar to the simile of the sheaves of reeds which the Buddha gave. In the agrarian societies, in order to dry the stalks of the rice so they can be used as fodder or whatever, you would lean one against the other so the air could dry them out. And that was this simile the Buddha gave for mind and what its objects, what it is aware of. If the things which is aware of disappears, so does the mind. Nama rupa, they call it. When nama rupa ceases, the citta ceases. Turns off. If you have nothing to see, sight turns off. Nothing to hear, hearing turns off. It is conditional, these consciousnesses. So what happens when your mind is watching mind objects? Say it starts to watch, be aware of the nimitta. When the nimitta starts to disappear, then if you're still conscious, you're conscious of something. What are you aware of? If you're not aware of anything, then you're not conscious at all. But later on, in the deep meditations, what you're conscious of starts to vanish. Now this is the deeper stuff. You've gone through the jhanas. You've had the bliss of the first jhana, which is, you're really incredibly aware. Second, third, fourth jhana. Fourth jhana, you cannot be more aware. That's the purity, that's the summit of awareness. The fourth jhana, incredibly still, but very powerful. So you're not sort of dull or dreamy, you are really aware, super aware. But then because nothing moves, the object which you're watching starts to vanish. And then the consciousness disappears with it. So the object vanishes first, and then the consciousness starts to fade away. And that is the whole process of the immaterial attainments. Until there's nothing left to watch, that disappears, and so does the consciousness. The citta ceases temporarily in nirvana samapatti. Another way of anything. You've gone. You disappeared. With your consciousness and everything else. It's not hiding somewhere. It's gone. And then, when you come out afterwards, you go back the way you came. But in the full enlightenment, you cease without remainder. And it says in the Samyutta Nikaya, afterwards, the six senses and what they're aware of cease totally, and no more sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, or mind arises in any place, in any way, in any form. You're gone. Which is a wonderful place to leave this morning's talk. You're gone. Actually, there's one more question in the back, wasn't there? Okay, yeah. Okay, to start between you, one of you did the question. Okay.
So, the more we go down the path for laymen and women, we want to help people. We try to help as many people as we can. But in the UK now, it looks as though we're going to be going in to a general election, and then you have Brexit. So this kind of political quagmire that we're in is also a potential way to help lots of people. But how do you navigate the political kind of the infinity of wishes, as you refer to it? How can you navigate that system when you're trying to help people, and how can you prevent yourself being caught in the whirlwind and stuff?
That's why it takes a lot of personal training, first of all. Many people want to help, and often they just cause more problems. They don't know what they're really doing. It's a very simple teaching. It's like the old Boy Scouts do a good deed of the day. So they helped an old lady across the road. The only problem was, she didn't want to go. Okay, I think we can stop there for this morning. Very good. So what do we do now? We have...
you have lunch at 12:30.
Oh, okay, lunch at 12:30.
Meditation.
It's your meditation. And I know it's really close to the end of the retreat. And I know that you are dying to talk to other people. But it's better to die than to talk. So try and keep the silence as long as possible. Silence is so precious. And this afternoon, after we do our stuff, then you can talk as much as you want. Okay, so. Sadhu. 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 Okay. There we go.